Hi, I'm Will. I generally go shampoo and then soap.
Huh.
I'm talking for showering.
No, we got it, guy. Sean, what's your loop?
I go soap first always and then shampoo.
Really?
Huh. I go bar of soap.
Yeah.
And then I only wash this hair every 4 or 5 days.
You don't have to say that out loud.
Well, but you know, if you wash your hair, it gets too fluffy.
You guys use moisturizer on your skin when you get out? Do you guys use moisturizer?
Yeah, I have a whole thing that I go through. This is no fluke.
So you look like that after all this care, too?
You need more care.
That's so depressing.
Why don't you cheer me up with a fresh episode of Smartless?
Yeah. Okay, yeah, let's go.
Smart.
Listener, Sean's got a little cap on, and he's got his little glasses on. He's the most positive, sweetest, nicest guy I think I've ever met in my life.
Yeah.
Will, would you agree? Would you agree?
I would agree.
Do you feel warm and fuzzy when you're around Sean?
I feel warm and fuzzy when I'm around you, too.
Yeah.
I love hanging out with you.
I love Sean.
I'd like to hug, because we're going to see each other tonight.
Tonight.
And I can't wait. I'm going to be all over you.
And we're going to hug each other, and we're going to hold each other for an uncomfortable long time.
Jason's been away, so he's missed the last couple, because Sean, we've done it a few times in the last week, couple weeks. We've hung out, and Jason hasn't been there. Jason, I know you were finishing up.
But by the way, we haven't said you completely wrapped Ozark.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Finished Ozark. Thank you very much.
How do you feel?
Congratulations.
I feel, obviously a little sad that I'm not going to see those people as much anymore.
Name one of them. Quickly, name one of them. Name one of those people.
Well, how about Linda Linney? She was an incredible co-star.
It's Laura.
What is it?
It's Laura Linney, dude.
Laura. Oh, Jesus Christ. 5 years of God. Why did she never correct me?
How about that Linda Linney?
But I feel like the audience is going to really dig this last season.
That's great.
We've stitched it all up.
Well, I love that. It's made a lot of people really entertained.
Sad and scared.
No, but no. What is that feeling you feel right now? You feel probably relief to a certain degree, and also maybe you haven't processed all of it. I don't know. I'm speaking for
probably.
You.
Yeah, probably. Probably stuff will hit me later on, but I do. The overwhelming feeling I have is a little bit of relief and some pride that we all didn't screw it up. I don't think, you know, because
we could
stay
all use
on
some
it,
pride in our life, right, Sean?
But a lot of people don't know. A lot of people don't know, Jade, that you shot the final two seasons, and now there's no more. Like there is
no more. Yeah, and I feel like I hope that we didn't screw it up. There was a chance that we
would. I'll let
we
you know.
Could. Yeah, you'll let me know.
Keep your phone on.
You're very honest that way, Sean. I like that about you.
Thank you.
Jason, how are you? Will you feel dumb 4 years from now when you're like, I can't believe I'm shooting Return to Ozark for the new streaming service?
Ozark also.
Yeah, the new Jack in the Box streaming service. You know,
Ozark 2, TOO, just like the wolf.
Yeah. All right, let's get right to it. Listen, guys, listen how written this is.
Oh, boy.
We all go to the doctor at some point in our lives to feel better, right?
Wait, we're not doing Hypochondriactor.
No, we aren't. Hypochondriactor is my other podcast. I do know.
Oh, my God.
We're not
doing
that.
Find it where you find your podcasts.
That's right. But today, we have the doctor of all doctors who's going to make us all feel a little better. I'm super excited to meet him and ask him a bunch of dumb questions because I know nothing. I don't even understand his title, to be honest. So that'll be my first question. But who's this doctor fellow? He's one of the smartest people on the planet. He got his MD from Yale. He is among the most trusted voices in America on matters of public health. He's the nation's doctor. He is the United States Surgeon General.
What?
Dr. Vivek H. Murthy.
What?
Good Lord.
Hello, guys.
There he is.
Wow, what an honor. Look at you.
Look at this guy.
Sean, you have outdone it here.
By the way, you look like, I know you get this every day, you look like you're 19 years old.
Well, I'll take that as a compliment. Thank you, Sean.
Yeah, yeah.
How old a fella are you?
Well, I'm 44 years old.
Oh, my God.
Wow.
How can you be 44?
You've done so much more with your life, Admiral, than I have at 51. It's embarrassing.
Surgeon General at 44.
Yeah.
This is, I want to say this is the second time? No.
Yes.
Yes.
Wow,
right?
I'm surprised.
And
you were
the 19th,
Jason, yes.
Is that correct?
He's surprised you knew anything. Did you hear that?
No.
That's what sorry, I don't mean to misquote you. But.
Yeah, no, I was the 19th Surgeon General under President Obama. Back during his second term, and now I serve as the 21st Surgeon General.
Right.
Sir, if I may, how do we address you? Admiral is okay? That's okay?
Well, so Will, I'm actually incredibly impressed that you know this.
Okay.
Because most people assume that I'm that general is my title, but technically I'm an admiral, actually. So,
wow.
But how did you know that? Most people don't.
You know, I guessed. And because you look like you have you had an admiral quality to
He's
you.
He's got a fast internet signal.
Well, how did you know that, Will?
Well, I got real fast broadband here.
Yeah. Now, let me ask a dumb question. Admiral is Navy?
Yeah, so great question.
Thank
you. You know, in the you guys
you didn't graduate high school?
So Admiral is Navy, yes?
So Admiral is Navy, but there are also other services that have the title Admiral or the rank system that includes Admiral. And one of them, so we have 8 uniformed services in the U.S. government, the Army, Navy, Air Force you're familiar with. One of them is also the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps. And that's the service of which I serve as a commanding officer. We have about 6,000 nurses, doctors, pharmacists, physical therapists, and we deploy them around the country during times of emergency, you know, Ebola back in the day, hurricanes, tornadoes, and now COVID-19. And so in the Public Health Service, we used a similar rank system to as the Navy. So Admiral is our equivalent of General in the Army or Air Force.
Wow.
Wait. What, again, sorry, what is that department that is uniform that goes out?
So it's the United States Public Health Service Commissioned Corps.
Okay. Wow, amazing. And so you said there are doctors and there are pharmacists?
Yes. Doctors, nurses, physical therapists, pharmacists, public health engineers. Wow. Most people don't even know they exist.
So in the middle of an emergency, your doorbell could ring. It's like, hey, listen, we got a massage coming your way. I'm a physical therapist, and I've been ordered to give you a massage.
Sure.
Well, we haven't built out that capacity yet for the massage needs. But
let me just tell you, my relaxation is critical to the security of this nation.
Yeah, right.
Admiral, where do we find you today? You're not in Los Angeles. You're in Washington, D.C., I'll bet. Yes?
I am. Yeah, I'm in Washington, D.C.
And a typical day for you is where is the office? It's not the White House, is it?
So I split my when I'm in D.C. itself, I split my time between the White House and the Department of Health and Human Services, which is by the Congress building. And, you know, we spend a lot of time also just there's no actual typical day because some days were like yesterday, for example, I was visiting a middle school in Washington, D.C. and doing sort of a virtual town hall with middle schoolers around the country for Get to Know Your Classmate Day, which is actually a sort of a national designation, which most people don't know about, but which is sort of a fun day to focus on social connection and community in schools.
Mm-hmm.
And other days, you know, I'm doing sort of press, you know, related engagements, you know, connected to COVID-19. Other days, I'm working on our commission corps and getting our officers deployed to emergencies. So every day is incredibly different. And we field a lot of incoming inquiries from the public. You know, a lot of people have questions about COVID-19, about their schools and how they keep their kids safe. But a lot of people have non-COVID questions, too. People sometimes send us their own personal medical questions. Mm-hmm. It's pretty extraordinary.
How did this come your way? How did you receive a request from Sean P. Hayes to
Why'd
come?
You say yes?
Yeah. How did this come through?
Let me just start out by saying, because I don't want to speak for most people, but I'm an idiot, and I really don't understand what it is you do, and I'm fascinated. I mean, I know a little bit, but I'm fascinated with what Jason just said. What's the day in the life of someone in your position, and how do you delegate? How do you manage what's going on and then deploy the help that's needed? You know, all of those kinds of things.
Yeah, well, I'll answer both of your
That's
questions.
That's why I asked you to come on, so I could learn. Yeah,
yeah, no, and I appreciate it, and I'll tell you when my team told me about the invitation from you, Sean, and from your team. And I was excited to do this because
they had to show you a photo of Sean. Like, this is the guy. And you're like, I guess still is not ringing any bells.
Promises. No.
That's it.
No.
Well, I'll tell you, most of the engagements I do are pretty darn serious. I thought it would be fun to actually do something that was laid back where we could talk about important stuff but have fun while we do it.
Yes, so. For sure.
I have one question this is a burning question, and which is this. When I go to school as a 4-year-old, when I first go to like first grade as a 6-year-old, let's say, what are the, because I remember going through this with my two older boys, I'm going to have to do it with my youngest son again, and remind me what I have to prepare my son for, what he has to be inoculated against when he goes into school.
Oh, yeah, great question. Well, there are a whole series of things that kids need to be inoculated for these days. They include measles, yeah. mumps, rubella, polio, and a series of others. And the good news is, like, this has been going on for a while.
How long? Like 50, 100 years, a lot of these, or longer, right?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, if you look back in our history as a country, the first real requirement around vaccination, around inoculations, was actually George Washington, President George Washington, right. Asking the troops actually to get inoculated against smallpox. Because more soldiers were dying from smallpox than anyone would have imagined. And after that, though, in the 1800s, Will, is when schools started to require various vaccinations, and they just increased. So now the vast, vast majority of schools in America have these same requirements around vaccines.
So most adults that I know, that you and I know and encounter, whether they're friends or we're having dinner, or we encounter them at the store or on the subway or in the parks or wherever we go, most of these adults—
How about
adults,
on a bus? On a bus,
or on a plane, or on a boat.
Or in a box, or in a fox.
Or on a train, or in a box, or in a fox. Most of these people, like 99% of these people, have been inoculated against all these things that you've just, they've received a vaccine against all these things that you just named. Is that true?
If they wanted to go to school, they had to, yes.
I'm just asking about those things, measles and mumps and rubella, those things, right?
Yeah, if they went through the school system, they did.
Huh, so right. If they went to school at all, then they did that. Okay, that's interesting. Okay, good to know.
So in some cases, you know, like there may have been exceptions that people were able to sort of carve out, but the vast majority went through the system and got vaccinated. That's actually why, that's frankly the only reason that we were able to get vaccination rates so high for things like measles.
Right.
And why we're able to contain it.
And so everybody, and whether it doesn't matter what vocation you're in, if you're an athlete, you're a podcaster, or whatever it is that you did.
What if you're an airline pilot or something?
Or airline pilot too, sure. But let's say
a logger.
Yeah, or a logger, any of those things. Any of those things I named, a logger, airline pilot.
Right. Or gardener.
You went to school, you got inoculated against those things, right?
That's right.
Thank you, doctor.
That's right.
That's interesting.
Will used to be a lawyer specializing in cross-examination. What do you do? He'll box you in.
I'm just asking about those things that we've historically done. That's it.
So,
sorry, Jason, I cut you off. You were going to ask a question about his day today.
I was done. A full stop. I think Sean looks like he's got something.
I have many questions.
Here, let's have it.
You're instrumental in preventing the spread of Ebola and Zika viruses. And tell us what it's like to get information like that on possibly deadly viruses and how you go about stopping them before they become pandemics. And by the way, have those been eradicated? I don't know. And what are the odds that they're coming back?
It's a three-part.
Yeah, well, great question. So there is still Ebola, like, in the world. In fact, we are still, you know, working hard to identify and to, you know, control cases that have surfaced over over recent months in Africa. And that's something we're going to have to continue to remain vigilant about. But to your broader question, like, how do you react when these things come in?
Yeah, what do you do?
There are always
run.
Various threats that are running. No, we don't have the luxury of running, unfortunately.
No.
But what we've got to do, first of all, is just very quickly understand what's known and what's not known. And the chuffed part about a lot of these epidemics and pandemics when they start is that you've got enough to know that you have to worry, but there's still a lot of open, unanswered questions. COVID-19, perfect example, right? When it became clear that this is something that we really needed to worry about, you know, at the end of 2019, beginning of 2020, there were still a lot of open, unanswered questions. And so it's this circumstance where you've got to move forward with incomplete information, but recognizing that if you wait to get all the answers to all your questions, it's going to be too late.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of damage could potentially be done. And that's the difference between sort of working in a theoretical setting and working in an applied medicine and science, which is what public health is all about. And so it's, those are difficult times, and you got to quickly convene, all of your scientific expertise in government, pull together people outside government who are experts as well, and then make the best judgment call you can about really a few things. One, how to communicate to the public about this so people know how alarmed they should be.
Right.
But also what measures to take. Like, do you start rolling out precautions in hospitals? You ask people to take precautionary measures to reduce spread. So there's a lot of decisions that have to get figured out very, very quickly.
In World War II, Admiral, in World War II, they used to have this thing where when they were bombing, on both sides, when they were bombing, that people would turn off their lights, right? They'd institute a blackout so that the planes couldn't see. And there were a lot of people who were like, I don't want to turn my lights off because I want to be free to keep my lights on. And it wasn't necessarily that your lights specifically were going to, then they were going to go, there's London, because we see one guy's lights. But if everybody did that, then all the lights would be on. So it really counted on everybody keeping their lights off. And you know what? Most people did it because they didn't want to get bombed, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Bill loves metaphors.
Seems kind of simple. Again, I'm not drawing any parallels.
Like I'm picking up on some kind of a parallel.
No. I'm just trying to remind myself. I'm asking the doctor if that seems true for a lot of the things he's working with.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's a really interesting point you bring up, Will, because it points to a historical tension we've had in our country, right? And not just us, but a lot of sort of modern nations and modern cultures, if you will, which is there's a tension between the collective interest and the individual interest, right? Like, mm-hmm. you know, we all, you know, want to have our individual choices and freedoms to make decisions for ourselves. Sure. But then there are circumstances where those decisions tend to affect other people. The classic example is driving on the freeway, right? So we tell people, look, you got to obey a speed limit because if you drive at 100 miles an hour, your decision potentially can affect somebody else. Mm. And so, you know, and when it comes to things like the example you shared about turning your lights out, everyone incrementally reduces risk, right? Mm. You know, when people can't see or planes can't see where a city is and then they potentially won't bomb it. But also when it comes to health, that is true in so many circumstances. So what you mentioned around schools and why we have vaccination requirements in schools, that was done in part because we recognize that if a child comes to school and they're sick, there's a chance that they could spread that to other people. Even if those other people are vaccinated, some small portion of people may not respond to vaccines. Right? Mm-hmm. The vaccines aren't 100%, even though a lot of them are really, really good. So it's a step that we take to really protect the common good, recognizing that we have shared interests. And that balance has always been a challenge, right, for us as a country, something we have to negotiate often with every new set of decisions.
Right.
When you were starting to become a doctor, did you see yourself playing a role like this, or was your intention to be a much more sort of traditional medical doctor?
How'd you get the job? Yeah.
Yeah, it was absolutely not in my to-do list, dream list, you know, five-year plan. I'll tell you this, I actually never, I feel slightly embarrassed about this, but I never wanted to serve in government at all because I thought that government was one of the least efficient and effective ways to create change. That was my belief as a child, you know, growing up and just thinking about the world and what I wanted to do. It wasn't that I didn't think it was important, but it just didn't feel like it was like the right place for me. So where I was focusing my time was I was practicing medicine, you know, I was training in medicine. I thought I was in a practice and I would maybe do other things like build nonprofit organizations. I had started with my sister doing a lot of HIV education work back in the 90s. And we built our first nonprofit together. And I thought maybe I'd do stuff like that, you know, like sort of all in the private sector. But what happened was actually kind of unexpected for me, which is that in 2007, 2008, you may remember like the presidential primaries on both sides were kind of getting up and going.
Yeah.
And there was a lot of discussion, you know, on both sides of the political aisle about healthcare. And one of the things I realized is that a lot of my colleagues in the hospital, they were getting to be pretty cynical and burned out and pessimistic because they felt that the system wasn't really working for patients or for healthcare providers, mm-hmm. but it was primarily working for insurance companies. And so they were kind of feeling, frankly, pretty bummed out about this and not like, and despondent and not so hopeful. And I just thought, hey, if this is a chance, when there's a lot of discussion, maybe some real change could happen. Maybe we should organize doctors around the country to have more of a voice, advocating for patients to create a better healthcare system. So that's actually how I got into this world of advocacy and thinking about healthcare policy. It wasn't because I had any expertise. I was probably the least qualified person to like build that kind of organization or movement at the time. But what I lacked in experience, I tried to make up for in interest, curiosity, and passion. Mm-hmm.
And just straight common sense about what we kind of need, right?
Well, yeah. And then what I found, Jason, was that like there are a lot of people, like frontline nurses, doctors, physical therapists, who were seeing like what the problems were. And they had a pretty good sense of some of the things we had to change. But they weren't at the table, mm-hmm. right, when decisions were being made about what policies to put in place. So I started doing some of that work. But even with all of that, I didn't think I was going to do anything in government. Then a funny thing happened, actually. I was coming back from L.A., actually, to Boston. I went out on a red-eye flight. And I got off the plane, and I was, like, ready to go home and just, like, you know, crash in bed because I can't sleep on flights. And I remembered I had left my dry cleaning, the dry cleaning place. So I was like, oh, God, it's been sitting there for days. Let me just go get it. So I go pick up my dry clean. My hands are full, right? And my phone rings. And I happen to glance at it, and it's a 202 number, which is Washington, D.C., I didn't recognize the number, so I'm like, I'm not going to pick it up. Let me just keep going. Keeps ringing. Finally, something tells me just pick it up. So I pick up the phone, and it turns out that call was actually a call from the White House asking me if I would be interested in been considered to serve as Surgeon General. And I was like, where, this is like so out of the blue. Where is this coming from?
And you put it in your spam folder. You put that number back in the spam.
Don't ever call me again.
You know what I did is I called my then girlfriend, now wife, Alice. And I said, Alice, and who was in LA at the time, she lived there. And I said, Alice, I just got the weirdest call. You'll never ever guess like who this was. She's like, was it the White House asking you to be Surgeon General? I was like, whoa, how did you know this? This is like crazy. Where did that come from? She's like, I don't know. I just had this intuition. So that's how I actually ended up coming down this path. But I'll tell you the last thing, and this is the part that I never could have figured out.
Wait, did she put you up for the job? Is that what happened?
No, she didn't actually. In fact, she was far more loved by people in the administration than I was. She's, if you guys met her, if she was on this podcast, you'd understand why in like about 30 seconds. Yeah. She's a lot more likable, and she's just awesome.
Yeah, because you're a nightmare. But keep going.
You're not likable at all. You're super smart and kind and very sweet. Yeah. Terrible.
But I'll tell you, the thing I never could have predicted is up until then, I had lived a pretty hodgepodge life. Like I had, been building these nonprofits. I had like started a tech company. I was practicing medicine. I was teaching. And none of them really seemed like they fit together. Mm-hmm. Right. There was like people would sometimes look at my resume and be like, you can't make up your mind what you want to do. Like that seems to be your problem.
Right.
But the funny thing is in the job as Surgeon General, I find that all of those elements actually came together. You know, President Obama at the time and his team really wanted to modernize the role of Surgeon General. They wanted to think about, it was in the middle of the Ebola crisis when I came in, but they wanted to really think about how that office could be effective, as a public health educator, using modern day tools. And so I found that all of the experience I had built in my sort of tech company days, where I was doing a lot of like the UI UX work, in terms of like the front end, the sites we were building, that came in handy. The grassroots organizing I had done and building our advocacy organization came in handy to build our public health campaigns. Like all of the clinical medicine work, of course, came in handy. My basic research background came in handy. So it was in a funny way. It was that job that brought together all of these crazy disparate parts of my experience. Mm-hmm.
We get support from Canva. When your work, presentations, and docs look good, you look good. And you can design stunning work presentations, docs, whiteboards, and videos with Canva. Canva is an easy-to-use online design platform. It helps people design compelling visual content and is great for designing any type of presentation and great for any teammate. So our team at Smartless is using Canva when they're coming up with different design concepts for various things with related to Smartless and Smartless Media, because we have a lot of stuff going on. It's a busy crew, okay? And if it wasn't for Canva, they'd all be fired. Supercharge your work with AI-powered Canva presentations, docs, videos, and more. In just a few seconds, you can generate slides and text from a prompt. AI is built into Canva right where you work, so you can stay on task without any app switching. It's AI that's easy to learn and even easier to use. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva is perfect for any work task. Sales decks, hiring docs, marketing brainstorms, employee videos, you name it. Anyone at work can design with Canva. Start designing today at canva.com. Designed for work. We get support from Happy Egg. I love starting my morning off with farm fresh eggs full of flavor. At Happy Egg, all of their hens roam on 8 or more acres of land, leaving no mystery to why their eggs are the best. These hens are raised on 8-plus acres. I got to keep it down, because if my hens find out, they don't have 8-plus acres. My hens only have like 3/4 of an acre. And they're going to go on strike. Anyway, all of their hens are cared for by small family farmers and live their best hen lives day in and day out. All of this results in eggs with plump orange yolks that are full of flavor. I just, as I mentioned, I like to kick off my morning with farm fresh eggs. The difference is so glaring between an egg from Happy Egg and an egg that just came from clearly some kind of like sad factory. And you just have to taste it for yourself. If you're a fan of eggs, which I am, do yourself this favor and try Happy Egg Eggs. You will not be disappointed. You will notice the difference immediately. Get with the Happy Eggs. They're so good. Next time you're at the store, look for the yellow carton. Choose Happy with Happy Egg. Visit happyegg.com/smartless to find a store near you. And if you come by the house, don't mention it to my aunts.
My dad works in B2B marketing, but I never really knew what that meant. Then one day, my dad came by my school for career day and told everyone in my class he was a big ROAS man. Then he just kept saying things like, the bigger the ROAS, the better, over and over. My friends still laugh at me to this day. I think it means calculating a return on ad spend. One thing's for sure, I'll be known as the ROAS man's kid for the rest of my days. Why couldn't you just be a fireman or a lawyer? Why? You ruined my life, Dad.
Not everyone gets B2B, but LinkedIn has the people who do. And with ads on LinkedIn, you'll be able to reach people based on job title, industry, likelihood to buy, and more. Start converting your B2B audience into high-quality leads today. We'll even give you a $100 credit on your next ad campaign. Go to linkedin.com/smartlist to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/smartlist. Terms and conditions apply. LinkedIn, the place to be, to be.
And now, back to the show.
Let me ask you something because, you know, I have a bunch of really depressing questions to ask you, so we'll get to those in a minute.
Great, can't wait.
But what is the difference
Warn our listeners so they can go fix themselves a beverage.
So what about, what's the difference between you and Fauci? Because Fauci gets all the airtime, and he seems to be the voice of, has been the voice of this pandemic and all that's been going on with it, when it's you that probably is, just speaking of job titles, above him, correct?
And having to implement all these things.
Well, they're at different institutions, first of all.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know. I don't know this.
Yeah, Fauci's at the National Institute of Health, right?
That broadband connection is really working for
I'm
you.
Not even,
well,
you saw, I'm not even looking at that. I mean, I just happen to pay attention to stuff, and I have to be what they call naturally smart. Go ahead.
No, but sorry, Sean. I'm naturally stupid. But truly, I didn't know where, see, I don't know how that works. Like, isn't the Surgeon General the top, like, that's the guy who runs the whole ship?
Well, so it's a good question. So, and Tony Fauci is an extraordinary guy. He's a friend of mine from before. We worked together when I was first SG, first time around, and we work really closely now. So there are a number of people, actually, who sort of work as part of what is, I think, about a medical leadership team. And they sort of work in parallel, but also collaboratively. One is Tony Fauci, who's at the NIH and runs the National Institute for Allergy and Infectious Disease. He's been a leader really since HIV on every major infectious disease outbreak we've had. Mm-hmm. The other is the CDC director. The other is myself, you know, a Surgeon General. And we all have sort of different lanes, and then there are a few others as well, that we all have different lanes that we sort of occupy. So the CDC is putting out actual guidance, you know, based on the epidemiological research that they're conducting and data they're gathering. So Dr. Fauci and his team are focused a lot on research and sort of basic science questions around the vaccine, around some of the therapies or treatments that you can get, oral treatments and others.
Right.
Myself, I focus a lot on everything from mobilizing our commission corps to respond and support localities and states to doing a lot of public communications. So we do a lot of shared work together when it comes to decision making, and we certainly split up a lot of the communications work. And actually, frankly, I'm grateful for that because this is like too big and too complicated a crisis to like for like one person to try to figure out entirely on their own.
Yeah, that's what I was going to ask you about. Was it the rollout of all the vaccines, all the shots you guys had to move across the country and make sure that they were in all the CVSs and Walgreens and all that stuff? I mean, I'm sure you didn't get into the weeds on that, but I'm sure you were privy to some of those emails and the apparatus that you guys had to prop up in a week to try to get it out there and catch up for all of the horrifically wasted time. Was that an immense thing to oversee, to witness, to affect? I'm sure you'll be humble and say that you left it up to a lot of other folks, but that must have been overwhelming to accomplish, and which you guys did remarkably well.
Well, that's kind of you, Jason. I mean, you're right that the logistics are just, I mean, it's absolutely extraordinary how complicated they are, because even if you just take something as simple as getting vaccines to a pharmacy, right? Mm-hmm. they're different types of vaccines. They require different storages. They have different dosages. You, in some cases, have to advise patients differently on them because some are two doses, some are only one dose. It comes to getting them into doctor's offices. That's a whole other kettle of fish, right? Because doctor's offices have very different setups than pharmacies. They don't necessarily have big, deep, you know, deep freeze, you know, like, sure. you know, apparatus to like store, like in the Pfizer vaccine, which is required early on. So it's incredibly complicated. And not to mention that each state often wants to approach it a bit differently, how they distribute the vaccines, how much they lean in or lean out, whether they want to do big, large mass vaccination events or a whole bunch of mobile units.
Yeah.
So what we had to do early on as a federal government is really coordinate and support them with everything from funds to logistics to personnel, and we had and with metrics. So we had to be able to quickly measure like how we're doing in each state, because you don't want to wait 3 months to figure out something's not going well, right? We need to know ASAP so you can fix it. So I'll say from our standpoint, like, you know, I was, while I was not like, you know, calling each of the CVSs and saying, hey, yeah. you know, got the vaccine. We had thankfully a team, a COVID-19 team that had some really talented, capable people who were working on logistics. And every morning we would talk and talk through everything from what's the latest on the science, what's the latest on logistics, on distribution, on public education efforts. And we would go through all of that because, you know, every day so much happened and so much changed.
And I would imagine that without getting political, but given the last administration, you having already been the Surgeon General and watching what was happening / not happening with that administration, did you hit redial on that phone number and say, hey guys, if you're still interested, I'd still love to serve again, because I see that there's a bit of a hole there? Or did they call you? Were you super excited about that must have just been a really fraught time for you, observing and being on the sideline and wanting to get back in there.
It was a really it's complicated and frustrating year in 2020 for me, because you know, when you've been a part of pandemic responses before and you see, you know, the next pandemic come up, like you just, and this is not a political statement, it's just a practical statement. Like, you want to help, you know, you want to be involved, you want to serve in whatever way you can.
Yeah. How frustrating is it when what you want to do, that you're involved in public health and serving and trying and looking out for the best interests of the public health. And anytime politics, and again, all of us want to stay out of politics. When anytime somebody is sort of inserts that, it's like, no. I'm not here to serve a political agenda. I am, and you must feel going crazy. You have to keep repeating that in different ways of explaining to people, I'm not here to sell you anything
other than
I'm trying to make you feel better. And I want everybody to be healthy. That's it.
And there's a blueprint that we spent time working on and left behind, and then it gets ignored. And then so you must have been like, please call. And then they did?
Well, so this is actually what happened is very early in the pandemic, early in 2020, I had worked a bit with then Vice President Biden in the Obama administration, but he and his team had reached out to see if I could help just provide some support and advice during the early stages of COVID. So I did. You know, and my general philosophy was, look, if a decision maker, policymaker wants to understand more about a health related subject, as experts, we should help. Like that's our job. Mm-hmm. You know, we need to that's what we should do for the public interest. But I also had known him from before, and I knew that, he's very thoughtful about science expertise, like letting, you know, really leading with that first and foremost. And so I was like, yeah, you know, happy to help. So what happened actually starting in March of 2020 is his team asked me and one other colleague to start doing a series of daily briefings with him on COVID-19. And so it was a fascinating experience because, I had spent some time with him before. This was a whole different level of depth of engagement because we were doing these daily briefs. The team would sometimes usually in the order of half an hour for us to talk to him about like the latest status of COVID-19. But it was very common that these briefings would go 60 minutes or even 90 minutes.
Wow.
Because he was asking such interesting, detailed questions. And a lot of times I didn't expect him to ask at that level of detail. I mean, I was excited by it, but he really wanted to like get his arms around us, understand like not just what's going on, but like, what do we need to do now? What do we need to be planning for in 6 months, 12 months? How do we prevent this thing from happening a second time around? Who is most impacted? We spent a lot of time, for example, talking about like the disparate impact of COVID-19
right.
on Black and brown communities and yep. the impact, for example, the school closures we're having on mm-hmm. increasing, for example, food insecurity mm-hmm. among yeah. for many kids.
Which has not been talked about enough in this country, frankly.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And we, to your point, Will, what COVID has highlighted is that so many of the issues that we're now and have been reading about in the paper, food insecurity, disparities in health, mental mm-hmm. health, the mental health crisis mm-hmm. that we have, including among our young people, a lot of these are worse now, but they predated the pandemic.
Right.
I mean, they were bad before.
Right.
You know, we just were not focusing enough attention, energy, and investment on
them. I want to talk to you about the mental health thing because, you yeah. know, and Project Starfish, because I want you to tell everybody what Project Starfish is. It's really cool. But the mental health, clearly, it seems like mental health is the next pandemic. There is a mass shooting almost every day. And it's almost based on somebody who has had a history of mental health issues. And it seems to be getting worse and worse and worse. So talk a little bit about that and tell them what Project Starfish is.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you raised mental health. I mean, this was a huge issue. We had record rates, really, of depression and anxiety in our country, particularly among young people, incredibly high rates of suicide before mm-hmm. COVID-19 came. And then COVID hits. And just yesterday, I spent, you know, the day at a middle school, or part of the day at a middle school, talking to students about what their experience of the pandemic was like. And I can't tell you how many of them said that they felt cut off from friends, that they felt mm-hmm. They didn't know how to really engage with the virtual learning, and they felt like they were falling behind. Mm-hmm. Some of them found silver linings during the pandemic. They found things that they got really excited to learn about on their own. They were able to quarantine with family and like really deepen their relationship with them. But mm-hmm. but it was a real struggle for a lot of people. So mm-hmm. here are some thoughts on it. I think we have an opportunity now, like as a country, to really rethink how we address mental health, not just from the standpoint of how do we prevent mental illness, but how do we recognize that mental health and well-being is about more than just saying, okay, I don't have clinical depression. Right. I don't have a generalized anxiety disorder. That's like one half of the spectrum. The other half of the spectrum is one where we can be having pretty rotten days, you know, be operating in a funk, you know, with a pretty low level of emotional energy, or we can be operating at the top end of our scale, you know, really bringing our all to our work, to our family, to our community. And we never really talk about how to do that, how to train our kids and give them a foundation for enhancing their emotional health and well-being. And we've just got to see it as part and parcel of health. So one of the things that we've been working on in our office is something we call Project Starfish. And the Starfish, you know, so many of you know, Starfish, it's an organism that regenerates, right? And so we think of this as an opportunity, this moment, as hard as it has been over the last 18 months, for us to think, how do we want to remake ourselves as a society into not just what we were in 2019, but something potentially mm-hmm. even better? A lot of people are thinking about this, you know, on their own. They're kind of having second thoughts maybe about the job that they had. Like, is that really the right job? Or about mm-hmm. maybe the balance they had with time with family and work. Maybe they want more time with family. A lot of people have moved to be closer to family and friends because they realize this is not worth being far apart. Mm-hmm. But if we don't take a real conscious approach to this and intentionally think, you know, about what kind of society we want to design post-pandemic, how do we want our workplaces to support mental health? How do we think we should be giving kids a foundation in schools for mental health and well-being? How do we think as a government we should be investing in prevention up front and in mental health rather than waiting, you know, years for problems to arise and then trying to solve them? If we don't do that now, I worry we will lose a window of opportunity to act and to fashion a stronger, more equitable, more resilient society.
Can I ask you, in your position, do you have the authority, if you wanted to, let's say, if you wanted to start a required subject in public schools, like there's, you know, English, math, history, and you have to take mental wellness or whatever we would call it. Do you have the authority in your job position, or is that sort of the head of education? Or could you implement that unilaterally as a policy if you wanted to?
It's a good question, Jason. The short answer is no. And because a lot of our policy in schools, education policy, is actually very decentralized. So it's under local control. And that's why local school boards are often the ones that make decisions on things like curricula or on other subjects of what's focused on in school. But what we can do from our office, and we are actually working on an initiative right now around youth mental health, is we can build a compelling blueprint that we can work with the federal government on supporting, but work with states and localities on implementing, so that schools do have a sense of how to create this foundation. Because here's the thing, Jason, if you talk to parents around the country, increasingly more and more of them recognize that there's a mental health crisis, among youth in this country, mm-hmm. right? So they have questions like, is it because of social media? Is it because of something else? Is it like, whatever the factor sociological may
might be.
Might
be because of this podcast, but yeah.
You think it's having an effect.
Some damage is coming from this. Yeah, absolutely.
Social media, can we just get rid of it altogether? I think it's the scourge of our humanity. And I think it's
I agree.
Destroying.
It's so big,
hey, it is granddad.
Destroying
and you want people to stay off your yard too?
Well, no, and I've always wanted to know, and I want it because I'm never going to have this chance to talk to somebody, a health official such as yourself, Admiral. So I've switched it up, and I now will eat a salad, and then I'll work out like an hour later, and I find that flipping that, I'm burning all those calories that I
anyway,
feel.
Just so yeah, we're probably
are you out of your mind? Don't cut me off. This is important stuff, and people want to know because
you want to know workout before eating.
He talked about remaking I'm remaking myself, and it's incredible.
I want to know one thing. One thing, Dr. Murthy, because you were talking about. You touched on the mental health, which leads me to the next thing, which is loneliness. I know you've done a ton of research on loneliness, which I think is fascinating. Like, who researches loneliness? And I think it's such a common fear, especially as one gets older, and a lot of people are embarrassed to admit it, right? Admit that that's a fear. And I know it's one of mine. I think everybody thinks about it.
Well, we couldn't tell, because you've just spent 10 minutes on this question.
Right. Anyway, wait, where are you all going? Where are you going? Was my question too long? Where are you going?
I think I see them backing away. Uh-huh. I don't know what that's all about. But yeah, it's really interesting. I totally didn't think I was going to think about research or work on that issue of loneliness when I started my term as Surgeon General. But what happened to me is I spent a lot of time talking to people around the country. And what they would say to me are things like, I feel like I've got to handle all of these struggles in my life by myself. Mm-hmm. Or I feel if I disappear tomorrow, nobody would even notice. Or I walk around just feeling totally invisible. Mm-hmm. And this wasn't just, people who are living alone at the end stages of their life who were saying this. I'm talking about college kids on campuses surrounded by thousands of other kids who were saying this. I'm talking about people who go to work every day in busy office settings surrounded by lots of people who were saying this.
Yeah, I've heard, because Sean, you were saying that you had gone, because of having to wear a mask, you went to Gelson's and nobody recognized you and you felt like just you were invisible for
That's
the first
correct.
Time.
That's correct. And then at the checkout, I pulled my mask down and I felt better about myself.
Yeah, and you got back into your Tesla and you said to Scotty, I just feel so
invisible.
Admiral, what is so much about how to keep your body right and to stay healthy. What is the least healthy thing you do to yourself?
Here we go.
That you probably should not tell America, but you're going to on the Smartless podcast. What's your guilty damage? Is it sugar? Is it salt? Or is it you smoke 3 packs a day? That's what it is, right?
No, I'm not going to. I don't smoke 3 packs a day. Mm-hmm. But here's where I am actually really falling short.
Because your own label is on those things. Go ahead.
Yes, actually. Mm-hmm. There is a Surgeon General's warning on cigarettes and on alcohol bottles, so, mm-hmm. Which is actually the primary reason that people know the title Surgeon General, that they see it on these things.
Right, of
and
course.
Some people think I spend all my days stamping boxes of cigarettes with warnings, but that is not the case. Someone's got to do it.
So what are you doing that is bad?
So what I'm doing that's where I'm falling short is around sleep. Right. So what I really should be doing is I should be sleeping, somewhere around 8 hours a night. 7 to 9 is what most people need. I should be sleeping at a consistent time each night.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I should be keeping distractions away from me when I sleep, like phones, all that
sleep
kind of stuff.
Hygiene. Sleep hygiene.
Exactly. Sleep hygiene. And that's something I want to do, but I've struggled with that. Like I haven't prioritized and executed on getting to
bed. And is that because of work? Is that because of family? Is that because of the balance of the two? Or you've always been wired that way?
It's work. He's got to keep his phone on for Biden for Biden to hit him with a text in case he's sending you a bunch of kiddies on skateboards, right? And that's keeping you up late, and it's pissing you off. You got to just go on Do Not Disturb on the.
Oh, I'll love this one. Yeah.
No. That's definitely not the case for the president. But it's actually a couple things. I mean, one is like it's I've never been somebody who's been consistent about sleep across my life. So it's been kind of a lifelong
there
struggle.
There we go. See.
So the second thing is I'm generally have operated as a night owl most of my life, but I have to get up very early, so that doesn't make for a good combination. Mm. And third is I have kids, right? So I have small kids, and they're 3.5 and 5. And my 5-year-old son, he just refuses to sleep if I'm not actually next to him in the bed, mm-hmm. right? Like he threatens like go on strike, all this kind of stuff. So, you know, slightly embarrassing because I'm probably a bad parent for this, but like I just, you know, we've just like let him sleep with me and my daughter sleeps with my wife and like we somehow figure it out. But half the night he's like punching me, kicking me, like just like, you know, just making sure I'm still there.
I know how to construct a pillow wall between me and my kids like no one's business because if anything touches me, I'm up.
Yeah.
So I got to create a little pillow wall there.
My sons are going to hate that I'm saying this out loud. They're almost 13 next week and 11, and they still, at night, I have to lie with them in bed and put them to bed in that way until they fall asleep.
That's so great.
And it's just...
It's what we do for our kids.
It's just the way it is. But I will say this, Admiral, and I'm sorry, I hate to pull rank on you, but...
Nice.
Literally. But I'm like a field marshal of sleep over here because once I put the kids to bed, about 9:30, I'm in bed. I read a little bit, old school actual book. I put my device away, and I go to sleep. And it's very important. My sleep is very, very important to me. And I get up super early, so I don't sleep 9 till 9, but I'll sleep sort of 9:30, and I'll get up at 5:30 or 6 most days. And I'm just saying that because I want to flex that I have better sleep hygiene than the Surgeon General. And these are things you don't often get to do.
You totally do. And so that's an area I've got to work on.
Well, listen, this is the reason I said it. Because now what I'm going to say is I'd love to have the opportunity to come over and help you work through it. And I can talk you through it. And I feel like I could be a real asset.
Yeah, there's nothing creepy about
that. Just lay down next to him, read him a story.
I'm a sleep asset. Sorry.
I was going to say, like, you know, the last thing I find is really powerful about sleep is actually, and this is a bit, it sounds like a bit of what Will does, but it's like get yourself in the right place, like when you start sleeping. So, because our minds are just like going 1,000 miles an hour in 1,000 directions, right? And like how to like quieten our mind and calm our mind before
and get on that runway. It's like getting on the right.
Listen,
I've just had, I think you and I are just having the same idea at the same time. Are you about to appoint me the sleep czar? We need a sleep czar, and it should be me.
You've been putting people to sleep for years, Will.
It's unbelievable. We've got the last season of Ozark queued up, and everybody will be out. They'll be out. Believe me. Return to Ozark is the one that I'm doing.
You guys are hysterical.
And we will be right back.
From visionary filmmaker Luca Guadagnino comes Challenger, starring Zendaya, Josh O'Connor, and Mike Feist. Zendaya stars as Tashi Duncan, a former tennis prodigy turned coach who has taken her husband Art and transformed him into a world-famous Grand Slam champion. To jolt him out of his recent losing streak, she makes him play a challenger event close to the lowest level of the pro tournament. Her strategy takes a turn when he finds himself standing across the net from his former best friend and Tashi's former boyfriend, Patrick. Past and present collide and tensions run high. Tashi must ask herself, what will it cost to win? See Challengers only in theaters April 26th. Get tickets now at ChallengersMovie.com.
Hello, I'm Johnny Knoxville.
And I'm Elna Baker, and we have a new podcast. It's called Pretty Sure I Can Fly.
Yep, we've teamed up with my friends and barmates from Smartless to create a podcast where we talk to folks who have more balls in a bowling alley.
People who accomplished something extraordinary despite people telling them that it couldn't or shouldn't be done.
You'll hear stories about the Air Force doctor who buckled into a 600-mile-per-hour rocket sled and became the fastest man on the planet.
And a man who wrestles alligators and sharks for fun.
Do not do this.
You'll hear about a foul-mouthed moonshiner.
Got a 2-inch dick and a 6-inch tongue and knows how to use both of them.
And an even more foul-mouthed female stunt pilot. We got bull riders.
Balloonists.
Bobsledders.
And big wave surfers. People who lay their balls on an anvil and hand the other fella the hammer.
Okay. I bet you've actually done that, Johnny.
Maybe for sweeps. Follow Pretty Sure I Can Fly on the Wondery app.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
You can listen to Pretty Sure I Can Fly early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity, that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker
lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail, or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. I'm Guy Raz, and on my show How I Built This, I talk to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt and failure and talk about how they were able to overcome them on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
All right, back to the show.
I want to talk about climate change because, look, I prefer to sleep.
Stop looking out the window. It's not happening like that. That's weather.
I just stare at the window. I prefer cooler climates. I hate when it's hot, so I'm really angry about climate change. But talk to me, like, how does climate change and your position work together? What are you doing? What should we? Is there any good news about freaking climate change?
Or anything?
Are we doing anything to make it better?
Well, so the first question, like, my office actually does work on climate change. We did actually work a lot before when I was Surgeon General. We actually had worked on an initiative with the NIH and with President Obama on climate change and health, because it turns out there are some pretty big impacts of climate change on health.
Yeah.
For a whole bunch of reasons we could talk about. And now going forward, actually, in the administration, we recently set up, in the Department of Health and Human Services, an Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. And this is part of a much broader push on investing in, in addressing climate change, not just in domestically, but in terms of like global action that we're embarking mm-hmm. on. But look, it can't happen fast enough because these changes are happening in real time. We're starting to like see them. And sometimes people say, it seems like the temperature, global increase in temperature is really mild because they think like a degree or two, what's a big deal? But the downstream consequences are really quite extraordinary. So there is a lot of action and investment happening. The question is, are we going to be able to do enough? Are we going to be able to sustain it? If this is the kind of thing which, our investment and our attention to it waxes and wanes, depending on who's in office at the time or mm-hmm. the politics of the moment, that's not going to serve us and our kids well. Like, right. This is one of those things we've got to recognize. It doesn't matter what your party is. This is a threat to all of us.
Right.
And so we've got to invest in addressing it just like we would any other health issue.
Right.
No, all sort of jokes aside, we are in an existential crisis right now. It is alarming where we're at. And we don't talk a lot about stuff like this on this show, but we are in an alarming place right now on this planet, and we are in a absolute climate emergency.
Yeah.
Unless people come to terms with that and quickly, it's going to be over before we know it. And I know, I don't want to sound like a doomsdayer.
Yeah, but it's one of those things, though, that
it is beyond urgent.
So many things what can we do, right? It seems that, yes, you can inform us that it's happening, but what can we do? Okay, so if we're in the fortunate position of buying a new car, we buy electric rather than gas. If we, there are certain little things you can do, but for the most part, it's up to the government and the people to implement.
Jason, I know you're concerned because you were telling me the other day you were up all night. And you went from room to room to room, and you kept lighting on. You would turn on the lights, and you went to the guest house, and you went to the other room, and then you went to the other thing you're building. You kept going from room to room, and you got in the pool, and it was warm. You got in the pool, and you were just like trying to think, what can I do? I don't know.
Hey, yeah, go ahead.
Can I ask you guys a question, actually?
Yes.
On this theme of just trying to rethink what life we want after this pandemic is over, I'm curious, look, when you guys think about your experience over the last 18 months, I'm curious, what was tough about it, but were there also things that were unexpected and good that you feel like, hey, I want to keep that in my life post-pandemic? I don't want to go back to the way I was in 2019.
Well, it was that quarantining with everybody, having all that family time together was a silver lining a bit. I hope many people experienced sort of that forced gathering we were all into. I really gained from that a lot.
Mm. Me too. It was incredible. It was so many lives were lost that it's almost beyond comprehension in such a short amount of time. For my immediate family, it was a time for us to come together. There was a lot of, we actually had a lot of healing in our family in that time. Yeah. That was incredible. That otherwise would not have otherwise happened. And that I'm very, very thankful for, if I'm being honest.
Speaking of that, speaking of all the terrible numbers of lives lost, do you allow yourself to pat on the back is not the right term, but do you realize how many lives you've saved by being in charge right now, as far as rolling out this life-saving policies and some of the mandates more recently that have come out? I mean, look at how many lives have been saved from just the mandate of, like, you can't smoke in certain places. Like, that saves a lot of health problems with secondhand smoke. But this directly about the mandates of these vaccines, all these lives that are not being wasted because of the courage of some of the policies that have been put forth, that's got to feel... good, again, is not probably the right word, but it's...
rewarding.
Yeah.
Well, I do feel grateful, to have the chance to be involved in this kind of work, because you're right. I mean, this is one of those unusual circumstances in life where you can draw a very straight line between policies around vaccinating people and lives saved, and we're seeing that now happen again and again and again. I'll tell you, this is actually one of the reasons why I took this job. He was elected, and when the president and his team asked, me to come back and serve as Surgeon General, it was not a hard decision. And not just because I had been, advising him, over that that past year, but I remember talking to my wife about it. And we said, our kids are going to be studying this pandemic in school in 5 years, in 10 years, in 15 years. Like, people will be...
Right.
Looking at this for generations to come and trying to glean lessons from it, ask what went wrong, what went right. And at some point, our kids are going to ask us, like,
you mean on Mars? Because this planet's uninhabitable. When they're on Mars, they're going to be.
Well, I think at some point, our kids are going to ask us, like, Mama, Papa, what did you do?
Right.
You lived through it. What did you do?
Right.
And I want us to be able to tell them that we did absolutely everything that we could at a time where this pandemic was ravaging our country and the world, where we and our family had lost 10 members of our family to this disease seen many others hospitalized. Like, we wanted to be able to tell them, look, we did everything we could, that we didn't sit home and say, it'd be a lot harder to, like, go into government. We have a much easier life, in the private sector. We didn't want to give excuses. We wanted to say that, we ran toward the fire here. And so there's still a lot of work to do.
Well, I think that was a lot of people, though. Like, you, like, speaking, Sean, you ran towards the fire. By the way, if the fire is the chin chin on Sunset, he ran right towards it.
I wish that was the approach with climate, sort of addressing the immediacy of it, because I feel like if people lived traditionally to be 150 years old instead of, say, 90 years old, then maybe we would enact more sort of strict policies because we would actually be alive enough to reap the benefits of it, or the lack of implementing those policies, we would be exposed to the consequences of not acting. In other words, the cynic in me says that the politicians are not putting forth really good policies because they all figure, well, we're going to be dead before this planet roasts, and they're not thinking about their kids, and they should be, because it really is going to, things are going to come home to roost after we're all gone. We should be thinking about that, right?
We should be. And look, if you ask me, what do we need to truly accelerate our work on climate change? I would tell you that we need political courage. We need accurate information to be shared with people, not rampant misinformation that you see on social media right now. And the third thing we need is true grassroots mobilization.
Yes.
Right. Those are the three things we need in our country and around the world to really address climate change. Because you're right. It's not just about us. Right. It's you know, we, it's about our kids. It's about future generations. It's like, you know, do we really feel that it's okay to say that, yeah, we're not sure that our grandkids will be able to live in a world that's truly hospitable, that they're not going to be able to enjoy the things that we enjoy? Like, that's, that does not compute, I think, for people across the political spectrum. Yet, if you look at the way that this has been politicized, this issue, if you look also at the way that misinformation has spread rampantly about it, despite how much scientific consensus there is on climate change, you realize there's a disservice being done. And look, I got to say that, you know, on this point about the misinformation, we talked about social media earlier, you know, but early in the summer, you know, I issued a Surgeon General's advisory on the harms of health misinformation, just recognizing that not just with COVID, but more broadly.
It was awesome. I remember that. It was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. But, you know, one of the things that was frustrating me is that, you know, misinformation is not new. People have been lying for, like, you know, generations. But it's the speed and scale and sophistication with which it's been spreading, aided and abetted by tech platforms. It's really made now so different from the past. And what I've always said to the platforms and continue to say publicly and privately is it is not okay from a moral standpoint for them to allow the rampant spread of this misinformation, knowing it's causing harm and knowing it's dividing us further, and to just sit back and not do enough about it, or to tinker around the edges and say, you know what, we're trying to address it, or hey, look over here at all the good things that, that we're doing. It's like, imagine if I ran a hospital, right, and I was treating people like pretty well for like heart attacks and pneumonias and stuff, but I had a really high rate of line infections and surgical site infections and blood clots because I just wasn't cleaning my procedures and I wasn't taking the precautions I need. Would anybody say, you know what, that's okay, we'll forget about all those safety issues because, right, you know, you're treating. We would say, no, you got to do the right thing and you got to do it safely. And the same moral standard should apply to these platforms.
There's a very clear health risk and health damage with the misinformation. So why not make that as illegal as driving too fast or driving without a seatbelt or smoking in a bar? Or something.
Like, I agree.
It should be against the law because it's creating health harm.
What's tough for you is you have to find different ways to try to sell the American public on doing things that are good for them and encouraging them to do it. There is a culture in this country of doing things that are against the public interest by other groups. And it's so it's
by just
insane.
Being contrarians.
It's insane that nobody does anything about it.
Yeah.
There's no controversy when it comes to the environment. There's no debate to be had. They say, well, there are these other... No, there's no debate on it. There's no debate when it comes to the virus.
Because it's real.
The fact that we've allowed these things to occur is absurd.
Well, look, you know, it is frustrating because I'll tell you, as a doctor, even long before I was in government, the most frustrating moments are when you have somebody who's sick and you know what they need, but you can't get it to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Those are the most frustrating moments. Those are even more frustrating than the moments where we don't have a cure for something. Yeah. It's like you have the cure, you have the preventive tool, but you can't actually get it for somebody because the misinformation or some other reason.
They don't take the vaccine, but then when they get sick, they do come to you at the hospital to get fixed.
I mean, but I think there are a lot of people, though, who have been misled, you know, in our country. And this is why I don't entirely like fault, you know, folks themselves for some of these decisions, because if you are consuming a huge amount of misinformation in an echo chamber and are being essentially led to believe that that's all accurate, that's coming from trusted sources, then, you know, why wouldn't you think that some of these, that COVID's not real or the vaccine's not good for you or something, or some of these other fallacies. So this is why I think also that we have to, if we don't do something about the information environment in which we're operating.
And the misinformation.
It's not even just COVID.
No.
Everything else.
Everything.
It's climate change.
Everything.
It's like health reform. Everything becomes
And is that something that you can drive from your office, that sort of that policy initiative to sort of try to not regulate the internet? But
you were saying that you can suggest things, but there's nothing that you can actually, you can't mandate it. I think that these are things that have to come from a lot of different places and there needs to be a consensus, right? Am I right?
Well, so what we can do is, like, we can certainly draw attention to it, draw like national strategies for this, work together with the legislature, which form, you know, creates laws and regulations and work with other branches of government to use levers to push, you know, folks to do the right thing. But ultimately, I'll tell you, government, this is not a problem government alone can solve, because in people, it's when they speak up with their voices and say, look, we're not tolerating this anymore. We don't want to use a platform that's not curbing, you know, harmful information that our kids are being exposed to and others are exposed to. Like, it's only when people vote with their feet, ultimately, that you can have like the biggest effect. So it's not to say government shouldn't do something and can't make an impact, but I'm just saying that you know, for a lot of these companies, it's when their users start leaving that they worry, right? It's when their advertisers start leaving that they worry. And what I think is that this goes, the laws of, as I think of it, like morality and humanity are more important than any other law, right? And we have a moral responsibility to take care of one another, not harm one another, to do the right thing, not because we're obligated to by law, but because it's the right thing to do.
I love that.
And that's the cultural difference in this country that does not exist enough in this country that I love a lot. And I've never said that, but that I really do love living in this country, and I've lived here for many years. It doesn't exist enough. And it's, you're only as strong as your weakest link. And people don't seem to understand that. They can't get a grasp on it. And then there's too much of like, yeah, but I need to get mine. And I know that that's at the heart of how this country was founded. It was about sort of exploring whatever, no ceiling to whatever success you could have economically, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And that nobody was going to hold you back. But you have to understand that we are going to sink unless everybody starts bailing at the same rate.
Right.
Yeah. Here's the reason I feel optimistic about this, Will, though, is like I actually think that the majority of people in our country share the sentiment that they want to do the right thing, that they have a sense of obligation to one another. And then when push comes to shove, they actually reach for a better spirit, for you know, a better cause. They seek to serve and help one another, because you see that play out in communities day in, day out. You saw that a lot during COVID. But I think what happens is that there's a very vocal minority. There are people who I think manipulate folks, you know, for gain in one way or another, and it distorts things. It leads us to believe that we're a country that's more deeply divided than we actually are. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a large silent majority of people in our country who I think care deeply, want to do the right thing,
want
us all to get through this together.
I believe that.
So that's why I think these changes, cultural changes, ultimately are the most powerful forces that drive policy change, you know, in the long term. And that cultural resurgence, you know, of care, compassion, kindness, and love, that has to come from a grassroots level. That's why I, you know, sometimes people ask me, like, Surgeon General, why do you, like, talk about love so much? I talk about love because it's the most powerful medicine that we have. It's a force that we need now more than ever. It's than ever.
Also, it's all exacerbated by the fact that we can't see each other or interact with each other and be connected. And once you actually see somebody and connect them and listen to them and hear them, I think everything you're saying is true. It makes it more valuable when you can connect and even touch somebody, hug somebody, talk to somebody, listen to somebody. It all helps, to your point.
And you've been very constant and consistent, Mr. Surgeon General, in being that comforting, non-emotional, non-political sort of center of common sense in our country with this tough time. And so thank you for that. And please continue.
And I love that you keep going back onto falling back onto, you know, using love I think that's awesome. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great position to have. I think that it was the great Joe Elliott of the band Def Leppard who said, pour some sugar on me.
I love that song.
Oh God. Yeah. Dr. Murthy, thank you so much for your time today. We so appreciate you and everything you've done, everything you continue to do to make us safer, to make the world safer. Much love to you and much appreciated.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much. Hey, at the risk of taking us long, let me just say one last thing on that point just raised.
About Def Leppard?
This is so important.
Is it about Def Leppard?
Not about Def Leppard, although that was my sixth grade prom dance song.
Sure.
Pour some sugar on me. No, but just to say this point about love, this to me is a defining question of our time right now. Fundamentally, I believe that there are two forces ultimately that drive us in our decision-making. There's love and there's fear, and they have different manifestations, right? Fear can show up as anger, as insecurity, as jealousy, as rage, you know, but...
Yeah, to me, it's the Empire and the Rebellion from Star Wars, but keep going.
Right, but love can also show up as kindness and generosity and empathy. And in every moment in our life, when we're making decisions, whether it's about how we treat a stranger, how we treat the person next to us that we know and our neighbor, our family, we have this choice, you know, how we react to the news, whether we choose to turn on the TV or turn off the TV, we have a choice to make. And what strikes me is that because we each have a choice, we each have power, right? And so if we are looking to build a culture that is rooted in love and not fear, that is a choice we have to ask ourselves how to make each day in the small decisions and in the big decisions. And I started thinking about this 5.5 years ago when we found out that we were pregnant with our first child. And I still remember coming home And my wife was sitting at the dining room chair, just a few feet away from here. And she just looked really happy. And I was like, what's going on? And she showed me the pregnancy test indicator, which was positive. And we were just so thrilled and so excited to be parents. But I remember sitting down on the bed next to her and just pausing for a moment, letting it sink in. But there was a part of me which was got anxious. I was like, oh my God, like what kind of world are we bringing our child into? Like, is this going to be a world where people, you know, help our child up when he falls down? Or is this going to be a hostile, sort of fearful, angry world? And it was in that moment that it really solidified within me that as a parent, like my responsibility now was to make sure that the world for my child and for other children was more likely to be grounded in love rather than fear. And that had to be done through the choices that I made in my life, mm-hmm. in whatever sphere, my personal life, my work life, et cetera. And that's why it can, at a time when so many people feel disempowered and feel like the problems that we're facing are so big and too big for them to make a difference in on their own, I just want us to never forget that we have the power to choose between love and fear, and the ripple effects that we have on other people when we do that, directly, the example we set indirectly for those who may not say anything to us but are impacted by our example, that is powerful. That is how culture changes. That's how our country will change. That's how we will become better and create a better world for our kids as well.
Yeah. Amen. Mm.
Yep. That's so great.
That's fantastic. What a wonderful...
Thank you for that.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Murthy. That's fantastic. By the way, that's... we should just air that everywhere, everything you just said.
That'll
just
be our little teaser.
Clip. Yeah, it'll be a little teaser. Thank you so much for being
thank
here.
Thank you for
really
giving us some of your
time. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for your service.
Yeah.
Well, thank you all so much. I really enjoyed talking to you. And I got to say, even when I still had the little cover over my lens, just hearing the love and brotherhood between you guys and the good humor was, it made me feel good. So, okay. And then Jason, I got to tell you before you leave that Couples Retreat, watched that movie so many times, loved it, hysterical, kept me laughing. So thank you for
thank
that.
Thank you. Yeah, that was fun to do. All right. Well, thank you so much. Enjoy the rest of your weekend and we'll see you on the TV.
All right. Take care.
All right.
Bye-bye, guys.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Sean, how'd that come about? What do you have a number on the White House?
I was talking to our producer, Michael Grant Terry, and we were just coming out. And I go, you know, I really want to chat. I love stuff like that. I love jobs that I don't know anything about. I want to learn about. How do you do that? Why do you do that? All that kind of stuff. I think it's fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as much as I love all of our super fancy Hollywood friends, it's so nice to have somebody from science or music or mm-hmm. art or anything other than Hollywood. And then we get the Surgeon General, for God's sakes.
Yeah, I love
nice
it.
Going.
Super yeah. fun. There's so many other things. I wanted to talk about loneliness, I think, because he did all these studies on it. And I think it's fascinating. But yeah. We can do it next time.
Yeah, promise?
Yeah, promises.
Next time what?
No, this is your last episode, Sean.
What are you talking about?
This is it.
Yeah. Did you check your email? Yeah.
Okay, great. Let me just check
no,
it.
No, but yeah. How cool is that? I mean, in a day and age where people... I love that he said that he never wanted to do that. He never wanted to go to public service. Never thought he could make any difference. That he does it under Obama. He becomes Surgeon General under Obama. Then we go through 4 years, challenging years. And he comes back and he says yes to Joe Biden.
Biden! Oh, that's
wow.
a good one. Biden.
Great one.
Smart.
Smartless is 100% organic and artisanally handcrafted by Rob Armjarv, Bennett Barbaco, and Michael Grant Terry.
Smartless.
If you like Smartless, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Get to the chopper. I'll be back. Listen, I gotta tell ya, of all guests we've had on SmartList, I don't know if we've had a bigger icon on our podcast than Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, what a treat it was talking to that guy. Arnold is an inspiration, from having reached the heights of bodybuilding to then conquer Hollywood and become a global movie star. Oh, and for his third act, he oversaw the world's fifth largest economy as governor of California. The man has truly done it all. In our interview, he shares the secret of how he's able to accomplish what he puts his mind to, what motivates him to keep working out all these years, and the extreme generosity that he received after arriving in America. You gotta listen to this episode to hear what it's like to be Chris Pratt's father-in-law and how Arnold's first comedy, Twins, has made him more money than any other film he's done. Hint, he's also a great businessman. Give it a listen if you haven't. Bye. Seps.